Hello and welcome back to Learn It From a Layman. I am Carl Christensen. I'm joined by Dr. Johnny.
Hello, everybody.
And usually Johnny is instructing us, but now I am the master.
Yes, I think you have a master's degree, so technically that is true.
That's right. The one time I'm actually, know something about what I'm talking about, kind of. I guess that's to be determined.
I'll address maybe. You as Master Carl today.
That's not offensive. Okay, but before we start, we're going to talk about the basics of vocabulary. What that, you know, why vocabulary matters, what vocabulary is, those types of things. Before we do, Johnny asked me, so if you're watching on YouTube, which very few of you are, I'm wearing a hat for the first time, and my hat is literally anachronistic. Like, I had someone comment on it this morning, and it made them sad, because, but Johnny doesn't actually know what hat this is. So this is, Johnny, you have any guesses?
It's a baseball hat.
It's a baseball hat. All right. Yes. Okay. Hint. I live in Southern California. And
it's an Angels hat.
There we go. This is an Angels hat. And number 17 is Shohei Ohtani.
I thought he played for the Dodgers.
That's correct. He does now.
Oh, okay.
Which is why my hat made someone sad this morning. Because I passed an Angels fan, and they're like, I like the hat, except it makes me sad. So, yes.
Well, I guess he's not even playing right now either, so.
Oh, he is. He's playing.
Oh, okay. I thought he was out for a while, but maybe not.
Yeah, he is not pitching because he got another surgery, but he can hit, and he's hitting the cover off of it again. So doing a good job up with the Dodgers, who I am not a fan of.
Go Dodgers.
Yeah, you can see your way off the podcast right now. You're going to be the new Tim soon, Johnny. You watch out. Okay, let's dig into vocabulary. All right, Johnny, what is a word?
Everything I'm saying is a word.
Yes. It's candidly, it's hard to define. There are linguistic definitions, the base unit of meaning, kind of the layman understanding of like what we're going to be discussing with the vocabulary is, and this, I don't know how layman this is, but you know what a lemma is?
A lemma?
Lemma.
L-E-M-M-A?
I believe that's how it's spelled.
Reminds me of lemming, like the games where the little guys just follow each other off the cliff.
That's correct. Yes. Yes. Related in meaning as well, you know. No, it's the root of the word. It's the uninflected version of the word. And so when we talk about like what's a vocabulary, you know, what is your vocabulary? How many words do you know? Like, we need to define what that means because, you know, the word, every verb in the English language can have all kinds of different, you know, tense, inflections, you know. So is, are, be, was, are those all different words? So those just different forms of the same word?
I guess if you're bringing up lemma, it's probably the same, technically like the same word with like the same base type meaning.
Right, exactly. Know. So I mean, honestly, there's no wrong answer there because in some ways, I mean, they're like, because if you use one of them in the context where the other one should be used, you use the wrong word. Right. And so it depends kind of on how you're talking about it linguistically, if you're talking about syntax versus semantics, but nobody wants to listen to that. I mean, nobody wants to listen to that. So vocabulary is a more layman topic. So I just want to make sure that we understand, like, when I'm talking, we're talking about how many words there are in a normal person's vocabulary, how many words there are in a particular language, what I want to define as word is lemma, like the root word, a concept, right? A unit of meaning. And that helps us because they're both useful definitions of the word, but I think most of us, when we're talking about what's your vocabulary, you're not, you don't want to know, like a toddler can conjugate the to be verb, right? But when we think, oh, I have a big vocabulary, it means I have lots of different units of meaning that I have put coded in a particular set of you know, letters. So,
yeah, something we do in pediatrics is we track, like, as a baby or kid is developing, like, their language skills, and we count even words, you know, when we're counting it, like, for a one-year-old or two-year-old, is, are they making sounds that mean something specific to them? And, you know, that can count as a word, or animal sounds can count as a word.
As my wife has told me about the way I speak. So.
That you're making animal sounds? She's like...
And and that if I make a unique sound to me, it counts. I can...
Yeah, Carl and I almost invented our own language once, mumbling so bad to each other.
Yes, that was... when we spend a lot of time together with someone, it turns out you can develop a set of communication skills that are extra linguistic. yes. Okay. But one other thing before we did leave this word definition area, which is actually really interesting, but by one thing, I actually mean two things. Morphology is kind of the different ways that we change these units of meaning for context, for like syntactic context, for semantic context. Meaning like the to be verb, when we change it in different forms, it is a morph, it's morphing, right? Like the Power Rangers, for example. And does anyone know Power Rangers anymore? Is that like so dated that it's like entirely worthless?
I'm sure they're like on season 400 now or something.
Someone's gotta be making money off of it. I mean, okay. Anyway, morphology in linguistics is the idea that, yeah, like word endings, inflections are ways to morph words. And so different languages do a lot of different morphological things with units of meaning with words. And so like in Turkish, the language is super agglutinative, which means...
I'm gluten-free.
Dang it. Well, that's why you're not Turkish, Johnny. Gluten-free people certainly struggle in Turkey. agglutinative languages mean all the morphemes glue together. So in English, we have, you know, this concept of, you know, standalone words make a sentence, you know. In Turkish, that, I mean, obviously, in any language, that can be true, but... what happens very frequently in and I'm giving Turkey, there are other, like Lushootseed is a language that I'm cursorily familiar with, which is very agglutinative as well. And what essentially that means is you take a base unit of meaning and then you can just add prefixes, suffixes, inflect it in particular ways, and you can get a full sentence in what, you know, we English speakers would often term like, oh, that's just one word, because when you write it out, it's just all together. It's just different inflections, different meanings, but their units of meaning can actually be morphemes, right? Like you can have a morpheme that has a lexical meaning, where, you know, some of the morphemes, like the S ending on English, that doesn't have a lexical meaning, right? That is literally just serving a syntactic function. But if you have meaning when you put a morpheme on it, like you do in some languages, and that is its own lexeme, it's just an agglutinative language, means it sticks to other words. That's entirely esoteric, as is the word esoteric, which it seems really unfair.
Can you explain to our listeners what like syntax and semantics, like what that actually means?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So syntax is like word order, how words structure around each other. In linguistics, sense, it's the most mathematical field in linguistics, kind of formalized, because there are relatively strong associations between different words and different phrases and structures that you can build up. And we do build up inside our in particular languages and in our mind as we're parsing and making sentences. And so it's something that's very formalized and studied a lot. And that's just the order that's demanded from our language for the words that we use.
Yeah, and it's pretty easy for a native speaker to pick up on a non-native speaker when they start using the words out of order. But it's not necessarily something that you can put your finger on a lot of times. It's like, well, it just doesn't make sense that way.
Yeah. And honestly, even sometimes in linguistics, that linguists struggle, like being able to tell you why particular sentences don't fit right for natives. But natives will agree. They like, I mean, especially in particular regional area, like if you get a southerner with like a West Coast person, they might disagree actually on some sentences that are syntactically correct. But generally they'll be able to agree. And sometimes for linguistics, it's just like, well, all the natives agree that it's not okay. So it must not be okay. And so, yeah, it is interesting. And there is interplay between morphology and syntax. Morphology, that idea between words morphing, and syntax, the order of words. It turns out where one is really strong in one language, syntax becomes less important. The trade-off. So if the morphology is stronger, you got an agglutinative language, syntax becomes less emphasized because a lot of your meaning goes into one word. So anyway, interesting linguistic aside. And then the other thing you ask about was semantics. Semantics is meaning of words. You know, we talk as a layman, it's probably heard, you know, don't play. What is the term? The phrase, don't talk semantics with me or something like that. You know, maybe you've heard that before.
Yeah.
Semantics goes. It's word meaning. You can start straddling the realm of not just like word meaning, but like language meaning, like where particular words are appropriate in particular languages and they're not. We're actually going to talk about curse words later. But as a teaser, we're going to keep this rated PG though. So anyway, that's...
You're going to bleep it all later.
Yeah. Okay. One other thing, but before we move on, is I highly recommend, and I think it's still around. That seems like I can't really highly recommend something that if I don't even know if they still exist. But I'm pretty confident that the WordNet still exists. We're going to talk a little bit here about dictionaries, and dictionaries are the layman are familiar with, but the idea in a dictionary, you have to sometimes put an entry in for something that is more of like a morphological variant of the same lemma. You deal with some difficult questions to answer in a very basic dictionary, where WordNet is it's very linguistic. It's if you don't study linguistics, it's kind of like, why do I need to look? But it'll show you lots of word relationships, whole nets between, which is why it's called net, a word net. Networks between words and how they're related to other words, because it turns out in language, a lot of language is like the coding of language is relativistic, right? You have to like ask, if you have kids out there and your kid has ever asked you to define a particular word, you're often like, I mean, you know what it means, but you're like, it means the thing goes to the other thing.
Yeah, sometimes it's hard to put into words something right. A word that you use all the time that you already understand,
right?
Like how to use and the meaning behind it. It's hard to put it into different terms.
Right. Exactly. So, and that's it's interesting to dig into those relationships because analogy is a big part of language. We store instances of words in our brain. And so our brain maps between instances in a lot of cases, which means we don't it's not like we break the word apart and store like properties of the word per se. We store clouds of words. So when we say one word, the neurons in that area like fire up and it's like, oh, I can think of other related words. I don't know what any of them mean, having to use a different cloud of words. Like if you don't know a word in that cloud, I don't have access to that cloud for you. So that's why sometimes it's difficult and to define a word. But all right, my camera keeps going in and out of focus, which is actually doing wonderful things for our YouTube viewers. It's preferable that it's out of focus. Okay.
Oh, whoops.
Okay, let's move on real quick. I got a couple things to hit on here. Okay, how many words are there in English? Johnny, do you want to hazard a guess?
I have no idea.
Five words. Four ways to skin a cat. Okay. The reality 5,000? Is,
I don't know. I have no idea.
It kind of depends on how you're defining word, once again, which is one of the underlying difficulties of having this podcast, but it's useful to at least have an idea. So some estimates have it as low as like 250,000. I think the Oxford English Dictionary has more than 500,000. I had that number up here somewhere, but and I'll find it later in the podcast so I can quote it exactly. But the but there are some estimates that it goes as high as 800,000 words or so hundreds of thousands. Let's just say at a conservative guess, we're talking hundreds of thousands of words. And the and English is not unique in that way. We're going to talk about a couple other languages that have also a lot of words. English is one of the more vocabulary-rich words out there, though. What did I just say, Johnny? I don't think what I said just made any sense at all.
You said one of the vocabulary-rich words English is. It's very vocabulary-rich. The word English.
I study a lot, Johnny.
So does that just have to do with English kind of being a mashup of several different languages and being able to pull words from and meanings from, like, you know, all those different roots that it has?
Right. Yeah. So it kind of goes back to your Anglo-Saxon roots as far as like some of the history of why, you know, English was a Germanic language, but then was had a strong, you know, influence from the Romantic language family. And so we have kind of this amalgamation of like a lot of our very basic structure words in English are Germanic still, but a lot of the more, you know, the lexemes, a lot of the, if you're talking anything that's technical, those are all going to generally be Romantic words, like French or Spanish origin, or you know, some that'll have cognates in those languages, where, you know, our very basic vocabulary is has cognates in German. And so we get a lot of both is what it ends up as. So a lot of Germanic and I mean, you can think about it with the way that we're often, so if you think about like meat and pig, and what is the meat of pig? It's pork. And, you know, they come from different roots, from different language families even, because of the way it kind of came up through the language. I won't dig into history too much because it's just not that interesting to the layman, I don't think. If you want a podcast about that, ask for it, and you'll be like the two people that we do it for. Yes, it does come from a lot of...
page.
You what?
We'll send you the link to the Wikipedia page.
Exactly. You and your one friend can... I have one friend. It's Johnny.
It's true. I only have one friend. Well, that's my wife.
Oh, dang it. Now you're going to get me in trouble, Carl. Johnny. I have asked my wife to be on the podcast. For those of you that are longtime listeners and wonder why you've never heard from my wife, it's not for lack of trying. I have invited her on many times, but She probably knows the podcast too well. And there is Tim that stops everyone from coming on.
That's true. He is the rate limiting factor.
Okay. Anyway, lots of English words, whether or not there are 100,000 or, you know, eight times that many. There are a lot of words that we can draw from and a huge vocabulary that you kind of need to be familiar with. So what does the average person know? How many words do the average, you know, English speaker familiar with? Johnny, should I quiz you on this one as well?
No, I think I failed enough on that last one that you can say that I have no idea.
Yeah, well, it is also kind of one of these ones that, like, different studies, and there have been studies done on this, right? There are various ways that to estimate it. Some studies say as many, the average adult has a vocabulary somewhere around 29,000 words. But there are other studies that have said, oh, it's significantly more than that. It's like 40,000. I think some of that is just how they're defining vocabulary. You know, what is the unit of meaning we're talking about? And then, you know, just different ways to measure it. Studies, if you don't have a lot of studies in a particular way, and Johnny, you would know, if you have like one or two studies on a particular medical issue, it's like, okay, like it could be a number of things.
Yeah, like you have your, basically when you do any study, the more data you have, the more accurate it is likely to be, but there's still some question as to whether how accurate it is. So,
yeah, exactly. So, the more studies you have, the better it is. Sorry, I wanted to revisit really quick. I just found the number. The Oxford English Dictionary says there are 171,476 words in current use. So. And then there are obsolete words, and the Oxford English Dictionary has this like 230,000 words in English, including obsolete words. However, that's to be contrasted with the Webster's Dictionary, also a very definitive source, which has 470,000 entries. So,
interesting.
Said it kind of depends on, you know, what our definition is. But yes, most adult native English speakers have some range of vocabulary, but somewhere between 20 and 35 to 40,000, which is a huge range, granted. But the point of it is to say that it's a small subset of the words in the language. No native speaker has control of, you know, of the full vocabulary of the English language, and they're different. So we're going to talk a little bit about what vocabulary even means. Like, are we talking passive recognition of words or active ability to use them, right? Because like you said, Johnny, like when somebody says, define this word for you or for me, passively you can like understand it, but actively, if you can't define it, it's hard to use it, right? And that's like a lot of people have this passive vocabulary. Like if you're reading a book, you can understand the meaning, you know, in context, and you just read right through particular words that are part of your passive vocabulary, but actively you'd never be able to put that word independently into a sentence because you don't control it well enough. It's just, it's not part of your active vocabulary. And so in that way, you know, our vocabulary depends also on what are we talking about, comprehension or production. As far as how many words we generally use, I think, real quick, one other study found that we have 42,000 words passively that most Americans can understand.
One thing that's I found from reading is there are some authors that, and I think it's because they deal with words so much that they probably have a larger active vocabulary, but they tend to start using some of these obsolete words. And I think that they're trying to sound, you know, good, or that,
right.
you know, that word has a really good meaning in that context, but it's like so difficult to read because your brain's like, I don't even know what that means. Like, I've never even heard that word.
Right.
So like when you're writing a paper and using a thesaurus to try to figure out, you know, like a word to put in, just make sure it's like a word that you would probably use and you kind of know what it means. And it's not just like an obsolete word. Otherwise, you're just going to confuse the reader, I think.
Sure. Yeah, that I think that could be like the when we'll wrap up the podcast here in about 5 or 10 minutes. But the idea behind vocabulary is that you have to have some type of recognition of who your audience is and what your purpose is if you're going to when you're producing language. But yeah, let's come back to that in just a second here. The I found it says the most adult it says the sorry I've got most adult native test takers range from about 20,000 words that they have active control over. So, except it's I somewhere between 60 to 80% of your passive vocabulary is your active vocabulary. So there, but like Johnny, like you mentioned, reading is a huge part of this, right? As you and it does depend on what you read. I mean, Dr. Seuss is fun, but doesn't add a large amount to vocabulary. Nonsense words are fun though. But yeah, the amount of words that you can control and the way that you use them, it brings up the next question I was going to talk about, which is a lot of what we do in testing in the school system, certainly in the United States, and I think all over the world, relies on vocabulary to be like certainly something we explicitly test for, and also an underlying element of testing in general, right? Reading comprehension is implicit in testing for lots of different elements of, you want to test someone's history knowledge. Well, you can't if they don't have an active vocabulary that allows them to understand history, right? So there's this active question. I think the layman, once again, is very interested in this idea of, how do I, is vocabulary really make me smart? If I have a big vocabulary, if I don't, how does that reflect on my overall intelligence? And there have been studies that show both. Once again, this is a frustratingly, it depends on what you're measuring for, right? The reality and the linguistic reality of it is that there's no question a positive correlation between size of vocabulary and success in school. Does that mean that you, if you don't have a large vocabulary, that you're unintelligent? It doesn't, but it means it will correlate to worse outcomes in formal education.
And, yeah, which is very, linked to reading level,
Right.
Kids that can read well, do well in school. And it's almost like what came first, the chicken or the egg, right? Like what came first, the intelligence or the vocabulary? Like if you if you work on your vocabulary and increasing that and being able to use different words and improving your active vocabulary and your passive vocabulary, is that actually going to make you more intelligent? Like, that would be an interesting question to ask and, doing like an IQ test. But then an IQ test is probably really related to reading level.
Right. Yes. It's very much this chicken and the egg scenario of like, well, if you don't have a vocabulary, how do you even measure intelligence? Like, what are we measuring? Sure. Some mathematical concepts you can measure independent of vocabulary. Like, sure. But outside of the mathematical, pure mathematics, and you start immediately involving language. And so can you get it tightly defined to a particular subset of words that are just, very structural, very base for, any human that speaks a language is going to be able to understand that in some fields more than in other fields, right? Like if I don't need a lot of language understanding in order to be able to understand how to cook, Right. Like some basic functional words, but I don't need a huge comprehensive ability to describe how I plated the food. And, you know, like I just need to know what ingredient, like, you know, some basic words and we're good to go. But if I need, yeah, if I'm defining, you know, lots of other fields, you know, John, I'm sure you see in the medical field as well, like you can have a very intelligent doctor, but if they don't, if English is not their first language, they're going to struggle in some aspects of the medical field.
Yeah, especially like patient interaction type of thing. And I was thinking about something else too, because you have, you know, as a pediatrician, I like to think about these kids that have some types of developmental delays, autism, things like this. And some of these kids, you know, have very, very limited vocabulary. Some of them can't even speak at all. But like, there's one guy that I follow on social media. He's like a piano virtuoso. He can barely speak, but he can just, and he's blind as well, but he can just play anything on the piano. He can just make up things. You can tell him a song and a style, and he can put any song into that style. But there's no way to like measure that as intelligence, but I would say like musically he's super intelligent, but if you met him on the street, you'd be like, this guy can't even order at a restaurant. You know, this guy can't do the basic tasks of living, which I think we all, you know, come to think, you know, we tend to think like if you can't do the basic daily things, then you're not intelligent at all. But there's just not a way, like you said, to measure that type of intelligence, because we're always measuring things with a test. And how are you going to do a test without language and vocabulary? You know, it makes it very difficult.
It's difficult for sure. There is one study I found that tried to do that specifically. And I think the methodology was pretty sound. I didn't dig in like super deep, but the conclusion said that the study presents compelling evidence that improvements in reading ability result in improvements in both verbal and nonverbal cognitive ability.
Oh, cool.
So the idea that, yes, by and large, the reality is what you're saying, what I'm saying, like it holds true across mature, but the reality is some degree of verbal intelligence does seem to, increasing that does increase your nonverbal intelligence as well. Some, you know, this study shows, which seems, this seemed relatively well researched and well executed as far as studies go. So, all right, let's move on to one or two more things. I mentioned, cursing.
Yes.
Johnny, you are like a foul mouth, like, I mean, you love to just let it fly, right?
They call me Dr. Sailor for a reason.
That's why you went into pediatrics, is you just need to let your patients have it.
I teach kids new words that their parents haven't taught them.
Right. So, there is the stigma behind swearing, right? Behind cursing, and the idea that cursing sometimes seems like it's unintelligent. And anecdotally, I've met people where it seems like those are the only words they know. it's like, come on, guys. There's more. I know you've got more than those 10 words in your vocabulary. But there, it's interesting, and I'll take the studies really quick, and then I'll talk, I think, about my linguistic understanding of the study. A recent study done like 8-9 years ago seemed to indicate that more familiarity with curse words actually meant correlated with higher intelligence. So people that curse, and the conclusion, the clickbait headline was, if you curse more, you're smarter.
Which isn't really what it was saying.
Right, exactly. And that's what all of these, I'm looking, researching for this podcast, and I having done the research, you know, years ago when I got my degree, I strongly believe that that curse words are the linguistic function of them is interesting, and it's interesting to study. If you are using it, and this is actually holds true for any word or group of words, not just, you know, our traditional taboo words in English, if you are using those instead of other words, you are going to start limiting yourself. And so what that study demonstrated, the one that everyone grabbed hold of and is like, ah, it's a good thing that I can say all these four-letter words because it must mean I'm smart. Being fluent in English and therefore also being familiar with all the taboo words and how they're used or what, like, there's nothing wrong with that. That's actually, there's probably lots of good things. You need to be familiar with the society that live in the language that you, so the study itself asked people to list, they had them list all words in a particular letter group. So just, you know, name all the words starting with the letter C, go. And they gave them a minute, and then they stopped them, if I remember correctly. And then they said, okay, now list all curse words, go. and so then they had to just as many curse words as they could come up with. And they the study indicated that people that were able to come up with more curse words also performed better on these other tasks as well. And so that makes a lot of sense to me. Like, sure, if you're familiar with your language, you're going to be familiar with the taboo words. You're going to be familiar with the non-taboo. Like, you're going to have good control over it. And sure, some of those come out in language. And that's, I mean, everyone knows that I might be the exception. I do not curse. But everyone, like most people do. And does that mean they're unintelligent? No, it doesn't mean that. What it does mean is when you start using those words at the as replacements for other words in like ubiquitously, like you're just doing it all the time, your vocabulary starts to suffer, right? You're just not stretching yourself, you're not allowing new words in your vocabulary, you're not exercising the cognitive ability that you have to you know, control that language. And so there was a study recently done about a cognitive decline and using the word, I think it was the word thing specifically, that if you start using the word thing all the time to describe, you know, like, well, yeah, give me the thing. You remember the thing? Like, that maps very clearly into cognitive decline. I don't think it's the exact same with curse words, but I do think there's a related idea that, like, if you're using curse words to define everything in your world, you're very tightly limiting your understanding of your surroundings. So,
yeah, it's like, you know, of course, these people that, like, for you, you know, you and me, we're not people that generally curse,
right?
But if I hear somebody curse, it's not like, what does that mean? It's not like, right, I'm questioning, you know, the meaning behind the words or like what they're actually trying to say. So I think that, you know, it kind of, I think a lot of times these news places, they try to make headlines to seem like, oh, people that swear are more intelligent. But really what it's saying, that study was saying, is people that have a bigger vocabulary are more familiar with the meanings behind curse words and more familiar with, you know, those words in general and being able to come up with them in their mind. So anyway, it's kind of funny how, you know, research, somebody can put out research and then it gets taken out of context in a way to make a headline and make something that's exciting for people to read, even though it might not be exactly what you think it means.
Right. Yeah. So I think, yeah, it's important to understand and curse words before you leave the topic, and they serve an interesting place in language. There was also a study done where, once again, I hope that I give these studies their due. It's been a long time since I read some of these, but the general idea was the researchers had you put your arm in a bucket of ice, like ice water, just frigid cold. And you had to leave it in there as long as you could. And one group of people of subjects were told, you can't, like, you can talk, but no cursing. And then they measured how long the subjects were able to leave their arms in the ice water. the other group was told, you do whatever you need to do to keep your hand in that bucket of water. And there was a significantly higher amount of time that those that were like just cursed like a sailor were able to keep their arm in that, because it's a way to release that pain and that emotion. Because with their arm in that bucket, and if they can like let it fly, they're like getting cathartic experience out while they're in that extreme pain, where like if you've constantly under, I have to feel like you're controlling that and controlling the pain. So taboos words have sometimes like a function, but yeah, I do think it's worth defining it linguistically and using it in the correct sense. And then it's also interesting all languages have taboo words, right? This isn't like some social construct of modern society or Western thought. Languages have taboo words. All do, all will, forever. It's psychological more than it is linguistic. I mean, it's both, but the idea that we have to have words that are controlled, that are special, that are unique and powerful. And in religious senses, but also in just purely guttural senses. And so there you see that sometimes in pejoratives. If you know what a pejorative, pejoratives are when words become bad. It's when that process of going from a normal word to a bad word. And that happens over the course of time. And often it happens around a concept. If you think about excrement, for example, poop. We're not happy with the concept of poop. Like, we don't like it. And it is like not societally accepted that like we poop and poop is a thing. And so like the words around poop very frequently across societies become taboo. And so the word, but it's an interesting cyclical set of words. Like you said, so like with kids, you know, we say poop, but over the course of 100 years or 200, like the words that kids used as kid words for that, for excrement or whatever, like at some point those become the taboo words. And you kind of get this cyclical, like what was, you know, what used to be an okay word is now an unacceptable word, right? Like, and so, and that's not 100%, but that often happens. What?
Like duty. A new swear in 500 years.
Yeah, I don't know that all of them do this, but some of them do. One that absolutely happened, the idea behind people that have physical disabilities. Once again, it's like the social awkward thing to talk about. Like, how do you bring it up? What words can I use to describe a person's particular physical or psychological or mental disabilities that I can use it in a sentence and I can talk about it, but it doesn't make me uncomfortable and it doesn't make them uncomfortable and it doesn't make society. Well, it turns out that's a super hard. It's just hard. And so the words that we come up with to determine, like, you know, was it 30 years ago? Like the word handicapped was just, that's what you said. That's that person's handicapped. And sure, sometimes you can still say that, but in some senses that's kind of viewed as like socially unacceptable. It's like physically disadvantaged or whatever it might be. And it's because the concept is like uncomfortable to us. And so
they choose a word that's not part of your vocabulary, mm-hmm. that it becomes easier to say to describe something, but then right. over time it gets more meaning behind it. It becomes right. part active vocabulary, and then all of a sudden it has these other connected words to it, right?
Like absolutely.
Like at first you're like, oh yeah, you know, like handicapped, like this is a cool new word, it means this and everyone can say it, but now it's like, well, now you can't say it because you're all of a sudden your word web, right, is like connecting to these other words that
right.
Right. that you have a relation with, and then it has more meaning behind it. That's interesting. Right.
Yeah, it's super interesting, and something we could talk about more, a different podcast, because there's actually more to be said on the subject. But I wanted to talk about two other things before we wrap up here. One was lexical density.
I'm going to take my leave there.
Lexical density is it's nothing more than like when we talk about, oh, this guy's got a big vocabulary, or she's, you know, super smart because she's got all these words. Alexa didn't know. Sorry, my Alexa just noticed that I was talking and didn't like what I said. The lexical density is a way to measure vocabulary density, essentially. So, because you've heard the people that generally, like, don't seem to be, like, super rich vocabulary, and then they slip a word in there, and you're like, I don't know what that means, and I don't think you do either. and so it's like, you know, if we're trying to measure some type of intelligence, or we're trying to use that in some meaningful way, to it's like, well, that doesn't actually reflect who they are, or like what their understanding of the language is, just because they have these two words that most other people don't have. And so instead, we can do measure what we call lexical density, which is essentially, you know, we have the most frequent words in English or any language, right? Those take up the vast majority of the words that we say in a day, right? I think we say something like 10,000 words in a day, or like the average adult says something like a 10,000 words a day. And like of those 10,000, like 90% of them are reused words. Like you only use it's like 2,000, I don't remember the exact number. I've got it here somewhere also, but a couple thousand unique words in a day. But can we measure that? Can we measure, and of those words that you use in a particular day, how many of them are like, you know, your very basic words that, you know, your high schooler might know versus your college level student? Like how active is that vocabulary that you have? And that's lexical density. Is we can measure how difficult, infrequent the words that you use are. So how dense are they? If they're not dense, they're very super lightweight words. Those are the ones that everyone knows, right? That's your communicative words. And the more lexical denser you go, the more that correlates with difficulty to understand for people that don't have a larger vocabulary. And so when we do things like study people's control of a second language, that is a big part of it. It's like how lexically dense are you able to read? Like if I hand you a medical document, what's the likelihood that you can understand that? Zero, right? If they're a second year English student, like sure, I can probably hand them, you know, like Harry Potter, and they can catch most of that. But I give them like a medical journal, what, 20%? Like, and that's some of that's jargon, right? The idea that there are words that I, as a very native English speaker and relatively well educated, I'm not going to get some of the medical jargon in there, but a lot of it's just specialized words that I have in my passive vocabulary, right? And so lexical density is a big part of it. So when you write, you can actually measure your lexical density well, and that's useful to understand. And this will take us to our last thing, and that's what you were talking about, Johnny, is the idea that when you write or when you speak, and honestly, even when you read, you're trying to grow these your vocabulary. If you're trying to do something meaningful with it, know what the purpose is, right? Like if Johnny is speaking to his patients and he talks to his patients like he's talking to another doctor, Johnny's the problem.
Yeah, that's yes, I usually am. Then he is the problem.
Right, but like that's like being not only controlling the language but controlling your control of the language. Like it's having that meta ability about your vocabulary to say, I have, like, I'm very self-confident in my control of the language, and therefore I will target my language to the purpose and the goal of what I'm doing.
Yeah, I think the most intelligent people are those that, you know, are able to take complicated concepts and then put them into very simple, straightforward ideas that are easy to understand. I think, like, hopefully Matt doesn't listen to this because he doesn't need to inflict this anymore. But I think Matt does this really well, right? Where he takes these very complicated concepts in physics and explains them in a way that you're like, oh, I get it now. I understand. Right. And in 10 minutes, you probably can't repeat what he said. But for that moment, like, you you were able to understand what he meant. And I think it just, it has a lot to do with your vocabulary, your lexical density. What's it called again?
Lexical density.
And your ability to understand your audience and be able to put it into ways that you are, that they're going to be able to understand what you're trying to say, even though it's a complicated concept.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that is absolutely true. And so, like, it is useful to grow your vocabulary. I mean, even if it, like I said, there are some indications that it correlates to higher intelligence, whatever. Like, generally, it's more just, it can be useful. But it's most useful to target, like, to recognize when to deploy the vocabulary that you have and the way to do it. And in some cases, it probably is helpful and useful to try to elevate people around you. If everyone is cursing like a sailor, be like, guys, let's just use these two curse words instead of, and let's only use them five times. but to some extent, it's also like, yeah, let's know our audience. Let's figure out what our goal is here. And let's try to bring everyone, in under the same tent here, so that when we're learning it from a layman, we can all kind of grow together. So, I think it's super, super useful. And I Matt's done a good job of it. And we've had lots of people on here that have talked about very difficult concepts in ways that are easier to understand. And so vocabulary can help you do that if you can deploy it the correct way. If you've learned a new word and you're super excited about it and you deploy it all the time, okay.
It may not keep the meaning that you intended to have.
Right. It's not helping. So real quick, the last thing as we end this podcast, there's something I mentioned this in podcast like a year or two or multiple years ago. There's something called semantic primes. These are base units of meaning. You know what prime numbers are in math. Think about that in terms of semantics. So this idea of being able to define a word using other words, right? A factor. So if this word, you've heard people do this before, like I do it, absolutely. My kids ask me a word and I define it. And my wife said, that's more confusing than not knowing the word. And so, I'm not factoring it correctly. I'm not getting down to these primes where like everyone has these control of these semantic primes. If you, and there was a university in Australia that kept this for a long time. I assume they still do these lists of semantic primes and try to use these semantic primes to define every word. Because that will get you to the very basic root meaning of it without having to use these intermediate levels of words that you may or may not have control over, in which case you lose the meaning of what the, you know, that grandparent word is. So if you can get down basic to these semantic primes, these words that there's nothing, underneath these words that you can use to describe what they are, right? Run. Actually, I don't think that is one of them. I'm going to.
I think run can mean a lot of things, but that's okay.
right. Actually, that one is what it has a lot of different meanings. But semantic primes are, here we go, kind, part, someone, this, words.
So does the general speaker of English, are they familiar with all the semantic primes? Is that one of the ideas as well?
Right, exactly. Or at least that we can all agree on the basic unit of, like, it's essentially mathematically defining the meaning of these words. So the words themselves might actually have multiple meanings in English. But what the semantic prime goal is to say, nuke all these other meanings. Let's all agree that this tiny little piece of meaning is what this means. And we're going to use it to build up everything else.
Okay.
If that makes sense. So you boil it down to the very basic bones and you tightly define everything, like to the point where it's mathematical. Like I could write an equation, and then I say, okay, I'm going to use that to define all these other words, so that it's not like, oh, it kind of means a thing. You know, like, come on.
Is thing anyway. The words?
I think it is. Hold, oh, some, well, thing. Yes. Yes, it is.
Very good.
Anyway. I can, all right. Well, let's wrap up there. We're going to talk a little bit of other languages, but we'll do that some other time, how many words there are in other languages. And Johnny, we've learned today how many words there are in the English language. Have we?
Tens of thousands.
Hundreds of thousands.
Dang it.
We didn't even get within an order of magnitude. All right, well, okay. I hope this was useful, and go ahead and increase your vocabulary and then use it appropriately. And we'll be back again next podcast with, I think the plan is right now, Johnny, we're going to be talking about biotech. We're having a doctorate in biotech come on. It may or may not be a relation of mine. And and she's going to tell us all about biotechnology and some of the really interesting things behind it. And assuming she's still available, which last I checked she was, that's going to be our next podcast. So look forward to that. That one's going to be really cool. And Johnny would probably have the most interesting questions, but Johnny's schedule is also one of the more challenging ones. So
yeah, hopefully I can make it to that one. That one sounds interesting.
Yeah, she's got a degree.
Honestly, I should anyway, but I try to skip those.
She's got a degree in biotech. I think some of her like research was in like CRISPR, like the DNA editing and stuff. Mm-hmm. So like she knows what she's talking about.
That'll be cool.
Yeah. So anyway, well, join us for that podcast. Until then, stay ubiquitous. Mm-hmm.